Welcome to Bird News. I'm Indy Todd, along with ornithologist Vernon Locks.
Wait. It's Bird News.
First Saturday of the month, we're conducting an experiment of sorts as we explore the bird world and see if there's an appetite for a regular bird program. And wait, fans, you can still hear Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. We're going to be encouraging your feedback. We'll be giving you all the info on how to contact us. This, of course, our debut program. We're going to be talking about some of the birds we're seeing in the region, as well as introduce you to our bird brain quiz, our bird call of the month. We're also going to be hearing from Sandy Comito in a little bit, who holds the record for the most species of birds seen in a single year. And of course, we'll be talking to you about your bird questions or stories. Our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is birdnews@wgbh.org. It's been a kind of wild and windy week this week. And we've had these little alcids blowing in for a while now.
It's been an exceptional string of alcid, what they call wrecks, basically. Alcids are these little – there's a family of birds called the alcids, and most people are familiar with Atlantic puffins. People know puffins, razorbills, murres. The smallest alcid in the North Atlantic is a little bird called the dovekie. Over in the European side of the Atlantic, they're called little auks. Mm. And they're just really like a starling size. They're maybe 6 or 7 inches long. Really attractive little black and white bird that looks like a – they look like a baby penguin when you see one. And – in fact, they really, every time I see one, I can't believe it. And when I find one or if someone brings one to me, they resemble a little tiny black and white bathtub toy. And they're just amazing.
And they can't, but we need to put them back in the water.
Oh, they are totally helpless. Their legs are so far back on their body that once they get, if they're ashore, they're going to die. There's no, they can't walk to the water. They can't do anything. So if you find a dovekie, as about a dozen people around the Cape and Islands, in fact, there were 6 in Falmouth in the last few days, 5 of those were brought to the Cape Wildlife Center over in Cumaquid, and I spoke to the vet there yesterday, Roberto Aguilar, and he had 5 of the 6 that were brought in were safely released. There really wasn't anything wrong with them. The other one was so emaciated and dehydrated that it died. What they really need, the first thing, that they need to drink water. Mm. And, of course, they drink salt water. They have special, they're able to desalinate it in their bodies. And so when you find it, if you find a dovekie, if it in your yard or somewhere else, really the best thing you could probably do, if it doesn't appear injured, if you take it down to some salt water, it's better if you find a place where there are not a lot of gulls, because gulls find, that's like a Snickers bar for a gull.
No.
They'll eat them.
Ooh.
And we don't want that to happen. So.
Yeah. Well, our bird brain quiz has to do with alcids, and uh-huh. We don't want you to call in with the answer. We just want you to think about this and see if you can figure it out. What other family of birds not related to the alcids has developed many of the same characteristics as wings to fly under the water? This family is only found in the southern hemisphere, and for bonus points, name a distinct difference between alcids and their southern hemisphere counterpart.
Right. We're talking about convergent evolution.
Tell us what that is.
It's two completely unrelated species. It doesn't. It happens in other things, not only birds, that have. They look almost identical. They're lookalikes, like twins. Yet one family. They're so completely not related, but they evolved almost exactly the same way to take advantage of a certain environmental niche or a food supply or something. So they're. There's alcids are in the northern hemisphere.
Something else is in the southern hemisphere.
I can't say. The answer to that question, actually, there are 2 families of birds that are sort of convergent evolution counterparts of the northern hemisphere alcids. And we'll talk about this at the end of the show.
Let me just ask you a question before we give the answer.
We're not going to give the answer till later, right?
No, we're going to give the answer in a couple minutes.
People are thinking about it.
Let me think about it for a minute. No, because they're Googling it right now to try to figure it out.
Okay.
So, Vern, somebody saw a puffin here?
Yes, I just got an email a few minutes ago. A couple was walking on a beach at First Encounter Beach in Eastham. And 10 feet off the shore with the brant was an Atlantic puffin. And with these winds, there have been no fewer than a half dozen puffins seen in the last few days. Actually, it made it onto some Boston. I was watching some Boston news.
Wow.
And one was found on a beach in Revere. And they had pictures of it on the news.
Usually you see them up in Maine, right?
They nest. They're actually really an abundant breeding bird in the northern hemisphere. In fact, there's something like 12 million puffins that nest on Iceland. And in fact, if you go to Iceland, they apparently are on the menus and the rest. They harvest a couple million a year to eat.
Wow.
And it has no impact. The alcids are able to keep up with it, and it's not hurting them.
All right. So we're going to give the answer.
I think
the big clue here was Southern Hemisphere, right? Penguins.
Yep, penguins. And unlike penguins, which actually penguins are incredible. I've been lucky enough to go to the Antarctic a bunch of times and seen lots of penguins, and they're amazing birds. They have more feathers per square inch than any other bird, but they literally, their wings, they fly in the water. They fly underwater. And because there were no predators where they nested, they lost their ability to fly in the air.
Hmm.
Whereas the alcids
can fly.
They can still fly, but they have a hard time getting airborne. Like if a dovekie or a razor, but they have to be on the water, and they come up and they start running and flapping, and they bounce along, so they skip along the top of the water until they get going fast enough to get airborne.
Mm.
I've been offshore. I've been out at the edge of Georgia's Banks. I spent the month of February there back when I was in college one year on a research boat, and we had some huge storms. And I'll never forget the dovekies were coming. The waves were 30 feet, 40 feet.
Wow.
And the dove, you'd see a dovekie fly, buzzing along. You can't see their wings. They're beating so fast because their wings are so small they can barely stay airborne. And they come flying right into a huge, they hit a huge wave, and they just disappear. They go right into the wave. They fly through the wave in the water, and then they come out the other side flying. It's like, what? It's great.
We have a cute picture on our Facebook page of a young man here in Woods Hole who found a dovekie. So if you want to check that out. And the best way to get to our Facebook page is to go to our website, capeandislands.org. You'll see the beautiful little picture there of the owl that Steve Junker drew for us. And you can click the Facebook page right there.
Wow, I didn't know Steve.
Yep.
There's another part to that answer.
Yep.
There's also there's birds called diving petrels, which are amazing. Petrels are part of the Procellariiforms. They're tube noses. So they, just like a shearwater or a storm petrel or an owl, they have like a double-barreled shotgun on top of their beak. And in the Southern Oceans, the taxonomy on diving petrels is very poorly understood. Right now, we have them separated into four species, but no, they might all be the same.
Hmm.
There's one that nests on this really remote. Anyway, the diving petrels are exactly, they've evolved, they look exactly like small alcids. They fly like a dovekie. When you see one, you think they're an alcid.
Hmm.
In the North Atlantic, we have one little alcid. In the Pacific, the North Pacific, there's like 15 kinds of small alcids.
So if somebody got that second part, they really know their birds.
If they said penguins and diving petrels,
they know their stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Joel's giving us a call from Brewster. Good morning, Joel.
Hi. I've already told you my story about the lesser auks that were swimming through the waves, steaming through that hole between Unalaska and the Alaskan Peninsula or the Seward Peninsula, whatever it is, into the Bering Sea. I told you that years ago, mm-hmm. So I'm not going to repeat that. If somebody wants to hear it, they can call me. But I do have a question.
Sure.
And that is, why don't I see more crows at feeders?
Why don't we see more crows at feeders? Huh?
Do you have a lot of bird feeders?
I don't have any.
Oh, I have bird feeders, and the crows are an absolute horror. They come and destroy everything, and they scare away the other birds, and they rip the suet feeders out. I have a lot of problems.
I never see that happen when I go to other people's bird feeders.
Yeah, I don't know. I see it happen a lot, and the crows. I actually like crows, but I don't like to see them ripping up the bird feeders and eating everything. So
yeah, well, that's what I thought would happen, and I like them as well. But I used to tend a bird feeder for a friend of mine whose house I used to tend 2 or 3 days a week, and never once did I see a crow, and I would expect at least a dozen crows. They all come in gangs, and I could never figure out why there never were, and I never heard anybody else complain about it.
Could it be that there was other food for them that they didn't have to go to the
feeders?
They
maybe didn't like the menu, what was being served at the feeders. Yeah.
Everybody else did.
Joel,
okay.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Joel.
They're there. I will Maybe I'll put out a bird feeder. I got a lot of clothes around here.
There you go. Put it out and see what happens. Let us
know. All right.
All right. Thanks, Joel. 866-999-4626 for your bird questions or stories. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, birdnews@wgbh.org. We also, again, invite you to check out our Facebook page, which you can find via our website, capeandislands.org. We've got a really cool video posted there. I think Samantha Brown put that up about starling murmuration, something I never heard of before, Vern, but I know you're very familiar with. This is really cool.
It's one of the wonders of the world.
Yeah, so tell people what it is.
A murmuration. How do you spell that? I actually know how to spell it.
M-U-R-M-U-R-A-T-I-O-N.
Right. Starling, flocks, blackbirds, big, any species of bird. I'm thinking tree swallows in the fall. Starlings do this routinely. And what a murmuration of starlings is, starlings roost communally. And as it starts to get dark in the late afternoon, the starlings all get in these very, very tight flocks. Although starlings also, in the daytime, whenever they see a predator like a peregrine falcon or a merlin, they also get in these really tight clusters, and they fly as one, basically. You know, it looks like a moving...
It's like a cloud.
Right. They've done a lot of research on this. A guy up in Upper New York State spent 10 years researching this, real ultra-high speed or slow-speed photography. And it's like almost like you ever go to a ball game and they do the wave around the stadium? Well, it turns out your reactions to the thing next to you, the starlings are able to react in some... It's like 200ths of a second to just instinctively the bird next to them. So these huge flocks of starlings look as one. In the daytime, when there's a falcon or a predator, it actually is a defense mechanism because the falcon could go really fast and go blasting into that group and clearly get them. But it's going to probably hit some of the other starlings with its wings. It could damage its wings, which would be fatal. So they don't go into the groups. What they do,
the edges.
They'll stay up and shadow the group, and they're looking for one that's wounded or injured, or everybody else went left and one goes right, and then the falcon goes after them.
Yeah.
But to see the murmurations at dusk it's almost like a smoky cloud moving.
It is so cool.
They
to
actually
see.
Do that here as well. Yeah. There's where any if you can find a place. I know that the bridge over on the Vineyard between Oak Bluffs and Vineyard Haven. Every night there's about 3,000 starlings. I understand that bridge is being repaired now.
They might not be there. Yeah.
But if you can find a place where they roost and get there at dark, you'll watch them and they go in these. It's fascinating. If you have a chance, check the
check this video out because this is a couple of young ladies who were I guess they were in a canoe maybe, and about a minute into it. But it is just wild. It sort of reminded me of when we saw the long-tailed ducks, but the long-tailed ducks were kind of all flying it together. This is moving all over the place. But there's got to be thousands of birds in there. It's just very cool.
It's awesome.
Let's talk to Crystal, who's giving us a call from Dartmouth. Hi, Crystal.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Thanks for calling.
I actually just wanted to say first that I was very excited to hear that you're going to boost your signal. That's the best news I've heard in a long time. I live in Dartmouth, and we have sketchy service here.
Yep.
Sometimes.
And when does that happen?
Mid-March.
Mid-March, okay.
My question is concerning pigeons at my bird feeder. They're kind of pilfering my bird feeder, and I didn't know if there was any mixes or that they don't prefer, or if there's anything I can do to discourage pigeons.
Are you feeding on the ground?
No, but I think because of the birds either picking through it or the squirrel activity we have, a lot of it does end up on the ground.
Right. Yeah, pigeons are always a problem.
Yeah.
There is something that'll do it, though. If you... do you have a lot of brush in your yard? Do you have some trees? If you make a brush pile or put some put some old Christmas trees, you may not like the way it looks, but it adds a whole bunch of defense for the little birds, and the pigeons like to be out in the open and see what's going on, and they rarely will go undercover like that.
Mm.
So if you put some brush or something there, I think it might work.
Yeah,
it has for me in the past.
That's a good one.
Of course, if there's cats in the neighborhood, which are bad, the cats will hide under it, and then you're sort of baiting the birds into a certain trouble. So It's, oh. You know,
I guess get rid of the pigeons first and then...
Yeah, and then lose the cats.
Right. Oh.
Crystal, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address, birdnews@wgbh.org. Joan is calling from East Harwich. Hi, Joan.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I have a story about bluebirds. And on December 2nd... we had three bluebirds came in, and they were scouting our yard. They got a quick drink of water, they ate some suet, and then they left. And then on the 25th of January, when everything was snowed in, iced over, and frigid, the whole troop came back, eight
Ooh,
of them.
Wow.
And they stayed for 3 days. They kept coming in and out all day long for the suet and the water, but not the water in the heated bird bath.
Hmm.
That's the other question. I have a question about that.
Yeah.
I was just watching a rosy-breasted nuthatch pecking away at the ice on the one bird bath, and that's about 5 feet away from the heated bird bath. And when we had snow on the deck railing, a robin was eating the snow, like about 8 feet away from the heated bird bath, and a male cardinal did the same thing, preferred the snow over the heated water.
That's why, so the why,
water
Brian,
had
why?
Warm.
No. I'm curious, when you said the bluebirds the first time, they didn't go to the bird bath, but were they eating snow or were they going to other water?
They were going to, I didn't have the heated bird bath at that time.
All right, so it was above freezing, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Some birds do eat snow, a lot of them, but a lot of birds don't eat snow as well. They can't really do much on the ice. That red-breasted nuthatch was, who knows what it was doing on top of that ice. It might have been pecking at something you couldn't see, because obviously it wasn't getting any, I don't think it was getting water if it was frozen.
Well, there's a little water melt around the edge because it's right in the sun.
Okay, yeah, and they need such a small amount of water.
Yeah.
Because they're so light, they only drink, we couldn't even register on us,
Yeah, but why wouldn't they go to the
they'll go to the heated bird baths. I've seen, they love it. But apparently it has to be really cold. Robins, if there's light and fluffy snow, robins, some birds will eat the snow, but a lot of birds will not, too. And so you're saying your heated bird bath is not working for you? Nothing uses it?
Oh, the other birds use it. I just had a blue jay out of it just a moment ago. Mm-hmm. And the robin will go to it, but it just struck me odd. There it was, 8 feet away from the bird bath, and there they are chomping down on the snow.
The birds are very adaptable, and they'll take, they sort of do what they want, but if there is open water available, 95 times out of 100, that's what they're going to go for.
Yeah, but I thought it was very interesting that the bluebirds sent out a scouting party to see what was
That's so cool that you got all those bluebirds.
Bluebirds are, they're
great.
Crazy,
Joan, take a picture next time.
Okay.
All right, thanks, Joan. Thanks for the phone call. Janet's giving us a call from West Tisbury. Hi, Janet.
Hi. My bluebirds during that time, my house faces south, the southern part, and it has an overhang, and there were several bluebirds leaning over the overhang drinking the icicle water as it dripped.
Oh, wow.
I like
kinda
how you
cute.
Said your bluebirds. Yeah. Do they come in at night and you
the
put them like in the living room?
I think last time you had the program, this lady that did CPR on the birds, I do it on bumblebees.
Oh, my.
They land in my horse tub in the spring, and they get stunned. And, I know there's a dearth of bees or of any sort, so I take them out carefully, and I breathe on them, and occasionally I just very gently pump their back.
Oh, my goodness, Janet.
And then I put them in the barn on a towel where the sun hits, and then they come around, most of them.
Aren't
also,
you good
I do
to
it
do
with butterflies and moths.
Wow.
Well, that's
the
great.
Other day,
I've never heard of anyone rescuing bugs. I love it.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
I've done it for ages, and then I had a junco hit the window a couple days ago, and it was still upright, but it was stunned, so I picked it up, brought it in, and put it in a bowl with some soft cloth underneath it, and peeked in about 20 minutes later. It was ready to go, and I took it out, and it flew out. So I'm always rescuing things.
Oh, we love it, Janet. We love it. Thank you for doing that.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Janet. Well, we've discovered something about birds hitting the windows. I got those little decals. I don't know what they're made of, but
why don't you explain a little bit?
Because
I was skeptical. I was very skeptical of this because I've tried lots of things.
We have bird feeders on some of them on our windows, and it was bad because some of the birds going to the window next were hitting the window, and it was happening quite a bit. So we got these little decals. They on the window they look a little bit like etched glass, but there's some sort of plastic. But they send out some sort of
ultraviolet thing that the birds can see. That
and
we
have not had a single bird hit the window since we put those
up. Which is amazing.
Yeah.
Usually the birds hit the windows because, the sun is at different angles. And if a Cooper's hawk or a sharpshin or a merlin, something comes ripping into the yard, the birds panic. Yeah. And even though they knew glass was there, the way, they'll slam into the window. So. Yeah. And this thing, Mindy's raving, singing its praises.
Worked.
What's it called?
I don't know. We have to find that out.
Okay. Anyway, it might be a solution to keep birds from hitting your sliding glass doors, your picture windows.
Yeah, exactly.
Windows,
and they're pretty. It's pretty. It looks like I said, it looks
like
etched
glass.
It's very
innocuous. It looks like an etched little hummingbird in
the
glass.
Yeah, it's not like the big, sometimes those big black silhouettes of birds and things. It's not that obvious
to us.
There's
nothing worse than hearing that big boom and having
like,
oh, no.
I know. All right, Bob is calling from West Barnstable. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Hi, Vern.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Great.
My issue is turkeys.
Mm. The country or the birds?
Oh.
All right, wild ones. Yeah. We've counted up to 43 of them in our yard.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
And they could stay if they didn't poop all over the place. Mm. We have a standard poodle, and we let him out to shag them. But we've actually seen a phalanx of hens turn and
run the dog off.
And so he leaves them alone now.
Turkeys are very scary.
Yeah.
I have to say I'm not a fan of – I love turkeys if I'm out in Missouri or Kansas because they're wild birds.
Yeah.
The turkeys on Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard they're almost like a – they're like a gang. They're semi-domesticated. They come to bird feeders, and there's places where they sit on the roofs, and they are very big, and they make really messy droppings. And
yeah.
I'm not a fan, and I don't even know how to tell you how to get rid of them, really.
Mm. Yeah,
you need maybe get a bigger, meaner dog and send him out. Go ahead, get those
chase
turkeys.
Them away, yeah.
Yeah. Well, they're gone temporarily, but they were with us for a good solid 2 weeks, and I just hope they don't come back.
Yeah, keep your fingers crossed.
Yeah, hopefully as the, it's getting towards spring now. Soon, I would think by the end of this month, they will start to, they'll pair off and defend territories and the gang should go away.
Okay.
And then hopefully hopefully it's just a temporary winter problem.
Right.
Okay.
All right, Bob, thanks for the phone call. We appreciate that. Vern, the Cape Cod Bird Club earlier this month, was the second Monday of the month that they meet?
I believe it's the second Monday.
Yeah, second Monday. We went up there, and Sandy Comito was talking. And tell us a little about who Sandy is. He did this thing. It's the big year. What is a big year? Tell us what the big year is.
A big year is bird watchers. First of all, a lot of them are really crazy. No, they're not crazy, but a lot of people keep lists. And when I was in high school, my thing was to see if I could find 300 species in Massachusetts in a calendar year. A big year started as actually Roger Peterson, Roger Torrey Peterson, the man who invented the field guide. He wrote a book called Wild America. And back in the mid-1950s, he and the most famous British ornithologist, a guy named James Fisher, Roger wanted to show Fisher North America, so they started a trip. They started in Gander, Newfoundland, and they birded their way down the East Coast. Then they went across the Gulf Coast to Texas. Then they took a little time off. Then they went up to Alaska. And this was, air travel was in propeller planes, and it was really hard to get around. Anyway, they did this big year, and they went to the most beautiful places before anyone, And to read the book, it's still one of my favorite books. Mm. I read this book like every year, and I say, wow. And I actually have been very lucky. I've been to almost everywhere they went except Newfoundland.
Mm.
Anyway, and they recorded, I think it was like 560 species of birds. The last two birds they got on their big year in North America were on Martha's Vineyard.
Oh, wow.
In August. And they were a roseate tern and upland sandpiper at Katama, which is I thought was really great.
Mm-hmm.
Since anyway, so it's now people they're from all walks of life. I mean, the big ear holder at one time was a teenager who hitchhiked around North America, had absolutely no money, sleeping on people's couches. I mean, he used to go into Howard Johnson's and take French fries off the plates.
Oh, boy.
And he ended up breaking 600 for the first time in a year. Anyway, so the big ear thing has grown. I don't know how many people read the book, The Big Ear, or saw the movie, but back in 1999, there were three guys making a very credible effort to go after the record, but they weren't really in competition. In fact, they didn't even know. They ran into each other at different places.
They were doing their own thing.
Right. A reporter for the Denver Post wrote a book called The Big Year, where he followed these three characters. And in 2004, he wrote the book. Then the movie rights were sold.
Right.
Ben Stiller bought them, and they made the movie The Big Year, which came out. Yeah. Two Octobers ago. Anyway.
But anyway, Sandy holds that record for most number of birds.
I digress. You see, that's a simple question. I just
745 species. But he spoke to the bird club. We've got a little clip here where he talks about chasing a bird.
I'm chasing one of the first birds that I'm called on, and it's called a purplish-backed jay. First North American record. And this bird was being seen in a place called Clint, Texas. I didn't have a clue where Clint was. Never heard of Clint. I go to my map book, for want of a better name. I can't think of the better word. I'm old. I forget now. And I find that it's 20 miles east of El Paso. I'm on the next plane going to El Paso. Rent a car. I got an address. Without GPS, we didn't have it then. I find the house. And it's supposed to be occurring, according to Bob O'Dear, who is running the Narba, it's supposed to be coming to the feeders in their backyard. I walk up to the steps, knock on the door. A woman, maybe 20 years older than me, answers the door. She sees binoculars around my neck. She says, "Come on in." Now, I came from New Jersey. We don't even invite relatives in. Anyway, I follow her through the house to the back, and there's a great big picture window. The room is dark, a couch turned to face that window, and two gentlemen are sitting there. They introduce themselves. One is a fellow named Benton Bassam. As I said, I never heard of him. The other fellow was Dwight Lee, his faithful Indian companion, I called him. He went with them during his big year, as more than anybody else did, and they were close buddies. And I sat there in that room waiting for this purplish-backed jay to show up. And he regaled me with stories of his big year, which was exciting. And he also mentioned, he said, "What kind of scope do you use?" Well, I was pretty proud of the fact I had a Balscope Senior, Bausch & Lomb, which I had bought 25 years earlier. As far as I was concerned, it was a great scope. I could see birds at a distance. That's all I needed. I didn't have high standards. I still don't. And he said, you've got to get the latest, greatest that has perfect optics. I said, "What's that?" He said, "Questar." I said, "I never heard of it." He says, "I know the guy who sells them, and I can put a good word in for you." There went $3,500. He then said, "You're going to Attu Island, aren't you, in the spring?" I said, "No." He said, "Everybody who is anybody goes to Attu Island." I said, "Well, I'm not one of them. I'm not going." He said, "I know the guy, and I can put a good word in for you." So before that day was over, I was obligated for more money than I spent in my entire birding life. This is a lesson for hanging around bad companions. You hear me, Jamie? Don't hang around bad companions. Anyway, the next day I finally saw the purplish-backed jay. Didn't get it that day. So happens, the ABA never accepted it, so it really didn't matter. It was a wasted trip. But it was fun. But I also met the number one on the big years.
And we should say these birds have to be on a list to count, right?
Right. To do a big North American, the American Birding Association is the ABA, and the ABA official area is Mexican border on the southern limit, and then all the rest of North America, including all of Canada and Alaska. When he was talking about Attu Island, the Aleutian Islands, which go off to the west from the mainland of Alaska, the last island out there is Attu Island. There used to be – it was actually in World War II. There was a big battle between the Japanese and Americans. A lot of people were killed on Attu. The Coast Guard maintained a base there for a long time, which is abandoned. And these birding tours that were running, they no longer go to Attu. They used to fly out and stay. You had to pay a great deal of money. You had to, and you had – everybody had chores and stuff because it was like camping inside of this old – it was pretty crazy. But Attu, if you look at a – if you look at the international date line or anything, Attu really is in Russia.
Oh.
It's so all the reason you went to Attu is many of the birds there were really Asian species, but they were able to count them in North America. So if you really wanted to see those birds, you just would have gone
that's
to Russia.
That's why everybody goes to Attu.
So it's on the big when he said NARBA as well, that stands for the North American Rare Bird Alert. And this was really before the internet had taken off, and there was a service you could pay, you could join up. This guy Bob O'Dear had a service, and whenever they had they have codes for different birds in North America. So anything, there's like A is code 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Anything over a code 3 is like, you know, red alert.
Get over there.
And so anytime a code 3, 4, or 5 was seen, they would call the person that subscribed, tell them about the bird.
Exactly. We should mention Sandy wasn't a big fan of the book or the movie. He felt like, I guess, didn't really represent the serious nature of what they were doing. And so he doesn't do interviews anymore because he doesn't want to talk about that. But he did talk to us after the talk for a few minutes.
People get involved in birding for many reasons. Many reasons. Some do it because there's a social aspect to it. Some do it because they're impressed with the beauty of what they see or the places that they go to. Some have a scientific bent. Others, we're almost like stamp collectors. You look at a field guide and you say, oh, I saw that one, that one, that one. Oh, I'm missing those two over there. As if it were stamps that are missing from your album. And you have to go running out to places where that bird might be. So that's what I mean by chasing. Also, chasing is when someone says, there's a such and such bird over by the lake. Ooh, I haven't seen that one before. Are you sure about it? Oh, I'm sure, all right. And so you run out there or you walk out there, and now you look for it. Maybe you'll find it, maybe you won't.
For me, it's always they got wings. I'm jealous. I love to fly. I used to be in the airline business, and the whole, imagine being able to fly. I sometimes have dreams where I'm a bird, I'm flying like over the, it's dawn, and I'm flying up some seaboard, I'm listening down to the different birds singing up, and it's like, wow. It's like a waking dream being able to watch birds.
Vern, have you ever done a big year?
When I was a kid in high school, I wanted to break 300 in Massachusetts, which while I was a senior in high school, I got 322.
Pretty good.
I've been all over North America, I think. But actually, the highlights for me actually were discovering new birds for North America, which the latest one was the red-footed falcon, which has been before that, the common cuckoo on Martha's Vineyard, which they just had a second one for the continental U.S. in California, Apis apis. It's just, you know, it's nice covering your home turf and finding just completely unexpected, like red-footed falcon, first one for the Americas, wasn't on anybody's radar, just so off the wall. And I didn't believe it myself when I saw it. I had to step back, you know, are you really seeing this? You know,
and this is the kind of thing you would hear and say, oh, I'm on a plane.
And I did. Only with the red-footed falcon, I was able to drive because I lived in New Jersey at the time. It was 2005.
Did you go see it?
Oh, sure.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
You know, maniacs don't change their ways very much.
Maniacs, he calls himself. No, but one of the things that's, we're lucky to live in an area that a lot of these birds come to us. You don't really have to travel all of these miles to find these birds because we get a lot of really interesting birds right here in our backyard.
The Cape and Islands are really exceptional for birding. We're very, because of the geographic shape of this place. Just think of North American sea. You know, think of all the coastlines, mm-hmm. and look at how Cape Cod, this elbow sticks out. It's like it's a miracle, really. And for seabirds, you know, with a nor'east storm, Cape Cod Bay and the Gulf of Maine is just ideally situated. It is the best place in the world to see seabirds from land.
Wow.
After storm.
Yeah.
People come in and there it's, you know, if you just for do a quick, if the wind is northeast, it's blowing from the northeast and it's going to the southwest. So if you're a bird off of, say, Portland, Maine, out in between Maine and Nova Scotia, the northeast wind kicks up really strong. It blows them. The seabirds go up against the shoreline to the west. They come south with sort of a quartering tailwind. They go south of Boston, Plymouth. They turn the corner in Cape Cod Bay and start coming up the north shore of the bay. And then when they get to the corner in East Ham and Orleans, all of a sudden they're in the lee. Mm. That northeast wind, they have some buffer. The Cape is blocking it. They fly up that lee shore through Wellfleet, Truro. They get to P-Town, and all of a sudden they're back in the roaring gale, the huge, and they turn and run with the wind. Instead of, it's usually precipitating, and they blow back up against the shores of Boston and stuff, and they keep repeating. It's like they're caught in a washing machine, and they get in this cycle, and the longer, if it goes for 3 or 4 days, more and more birds are caught in
that cycle.
And then
yeah.
when it clears, invariably, the wind, it usually is at night, and the wind comes from the northwest. So the birds are sitting on the water at night, if they can, and they get up in the morning. They don't like land. They see land, so they start flying around the bay again. But this time, when they get the first encounter beach, that westerly wind is pushing them right in along the shoreline, and they can see right across the Cape. And so, anyway, it's fantastic.
Yeah. So. All right, let's talk to Sebastian, who's calling from West Harwich. Sebastian, thanks for being so patient. Good morning.
Good morning. I've got a couple of dead bird stories. I love seeing the live ones, and there have been dovekies and common eiders that we've seen right off Harwich in Pleasant Beach, but just December, there was a hunter out. Well, I don't know if a hunter, I should really call him a shooter. And we did find a beautiful, healthy carcass. I know it sounds crazy, but it was an eider male and apparently shot off Pleasant Beach between Pleasant Beach and...
So this is in Pleasant Bay on the east side of Harwich?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
No, well, no.
You're not on Nantucket Sound. Are you on Nantucket Sound or in Pleasant Bay?
Nantucket Sound.
Okay, thanks.
And the bird was banded. And I looked up how to report a banded bird, and I found out that it was released just in 2011 off Lockport, Nova Scotia. That gave us a destination, and we're going to be heading out there this spring and visit our bird's point of release.
Oh, wow.
Did it say what day it was banded? Usually it'll give you the date where it was banded and when. Was it a bird in migration? Was it banded in the fall, or was it banded during the breeding season?
You know, I'm sorry. I'd try to find that certificate because when you look up banded bird and you acknowledge with the number and the details about where you found it, I think it's National Wildlife Service. I'm not sure, but if you look it up on the internet, they'll tell you how to do this.
Right. I actually reported 3 bands last week. Yeah. So I found out a lot of cool stuff about a paragraph. Anyway, so I'm just curious.
I have the certificate, but if you see my office, you know why. It's kind of hard to find at the moment.
my desk is...
I want you to give a destination for this next bird. Just last weekend, if you go past the Coast Guard light in Chatham and you head off to the Coast Guard weather station, there's a little beach. It's right off Morris Island.
Right.
And we found a razorbill carcass. This one was unbanded. So closest I've ever seen a bird because it's right in your hand with the deep bill and the white line across the bill. Would you please give us a destination for the bird that was unbanded so we can head out to another location other than Lockport? Where might that bird have originated?
Razorbills breed up basically north of... There's a few nesting in New Brunswick. Most of them are up in Newfoundland, the Bay of Fundy. There's actually a razorbill with a satellite transmitter on it that was put in on the bird in Newfoundland, and it's flying around in Nantucket Sound right now. It goes between Monomoy and, like, Hyannis. You can actually, there's a website, you can follow this thing's movements. And there's razorbills are actually quite common at this time of year. I just came across on a ferry from Nantucket yesterday afternoon and saw probably 45, 50 razorbills flying around. And, you know, sadly, there's some mortality, and occasionally you find a dead one. But you've got to go much further north. It's really quite hard to see them. They do. There's a few that nest in the Bay of Fundy, but you've got to go up further north. So I would recommend Newfoundland, where they're abundant.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks
a lot. Sebastian, thanks. Sure. Thanks for the call. Tom is giving us a call from South Dartmouth. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Mindy. Hi, Vern.
Hi, Tom.
I have two items. So one is regarding the relative harm or benefit of feeding ducks such as mallards. We have a couple ponds on our condo association. I have a neighbor who likes to go out and buy stale bread and go up and feed the ducks. And I tell him that that's not really a good idea. And he said, well, you have feeders in your yard. What is your position on the benefits or harm of feeding ducks? Bread.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I think I'm going to not have an opinion on this.
You don't want that mail, huh?
What?
I said you don't want that mail.
duck feeding. I've seen people that go and collect a bunch of bread from various restaurants and put really hundreds of pounds in the yards, and they don't even have any grass, and hundreds of mallards, occasionally a few black ducks come in. Of course, the neighbors hate this. Because you have this huge, and anytime you get a concentration of like any kind of bird, doesn't matter what it is, or any kind of wildlife, it's going to attract other things that are going to come to eat. In this case,
rats.
You're going to have things coming to eat the ducks, like Cooper's hawks, red-tailed hawks, things that normally wouldn't eat them because there's so many packed. How can you miss?
Mm-hmm.
You come in so. There's no.
So pros and cons to both.
And I'm probably the wrong person. I'd ask a veterinarian.
There's like just four ducks, and they come over, or there's the Canadian geese too, but not. We don't have a lot of them. But if you just approach anybody who comes by, they're heading over for a snack.
Mm.
But I know what you mean about throwing down a lot of stuff. It's not that kind of situation.
Yeah.
But he.
Yeah.
He says, well, you feed your birds. Why can't I feed the ducks?
Yeah.
The second question is, we were walking in the back of our property, a stream that flows out, and we heard an unusual sound, and we saw a bird that we don't see very often, and we're trying to figure out whether it could have been a kingfisher. It was, I can't find a really good picture in bird books of the one we saw or think we saw. It was robin-sized, and it had two white bands, one around the neck and one a little lower, and then a chestnut-colored breast.
Yep. Kingfishers are big. They have a really distinctive, loud, rattling call. And you're describing kingfishers are unusual in that they're sexually dimorphic, meaning the males and the females look really different. Kingfishers are one of the few birds where the female is more brightly colored than the male. And you are describing a female belted kingfisher. They have a white breast and belly, basically, and they have a blue band across their upper chest. And then the females have a chestnut or reddish band that comes down below that and then comes down on the flank. So you identified it as a female belted kingfisher. Nice work.
Yeah.
Well, maybe. I'll look that up more carefully online, or try to get a good picture.
Get a picture, yeah. Tom, thanks. Thanks for the phone call.
Thank you.
Yeah,
right.
We appreciate it. It's our premier issue, debut of Bird News. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address is birdnews@wgbh.org. John is calling from Harwich. Hi, John.
Hi. I have a question. We have a bird feeder in the backyard and got all kinds of birds in it. There are juncos all over the ground, and I'm wondering why they don't ever fly up to the feeder.
Because juncos do pretty much everything in their life on the ground. And they in other words, they're ground-feeding sparrows that live in, they breed up in the boreal forest or up in the tops of mountains. They will, if things get really hard and everything's snow-covered and frozen, they will actually go up and eat off a feeder. They much prefer to feed on the ground. So that's what they're going to do if they can find anything to eat.
Yeah, they're the cutest little birds, aren't they, John?
Oh, they are.
Yeah, I throw seed on the ground for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's it.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call, John. We appreciate that. All right, Lucas is on the phone from West Falmouth, and he is the young man I said who we had the picture on our Facebook page holding the dove key. Hi, Lucas.
Oh, awesome.
Hello.
So where did you find this little guy?
Well, I found it on Hilton Avenue Road on Wednesday night coming home from the fishmonger from West Falmouth, too. And then we found this little dove key on the road, and so...
Was it dark out?
It was really weird how we found it. It was just sitting there, just sitting and jumping around, waddling, literally. And it was just walking in the middle of the road. So we stopped over, and we then picked it up out of the road. And then we brought it into our house, and then we didn't really know what to give it, so we didn't give it really any food at all, mm-hmm. because that's what the Barnstable Sanctuary recommended.
Oh, that's good. You looked that up.
Lucas, what grade are you in?
Third grade.
Wow, nice. You ever see anything as neat as that little dove key? Wasn't it amazing?
Yeah, I see a lot of kind of different animals. I'm really interested in animals, too.
Yeah. What did you do with the dove key? Did you end up bringing him down to the water?
No. Well, we gave it to the Barnstable Bird Sanctuary.
Oh, good.
You brought it over to the Cape Wildlife Center. And come
good,
back.
That's a good idea.
You did a perfect job. Yep. You saved that dove key's life. Nice work.
Yep. Lucas, thanks so much for calling in and sharing the story with us. Keep your eye out for more dove keys.
Okay.
Thanks,
bye.
Lucas.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye, Lucas.
All right, awesome. Let's talk to Susan in Edgartown. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Hi, Vern.
Good morning.
Very nice to hear you guys.
Great
I just
here.
Wanted to mention about the phenomenon of the birds running into the glass and talk about what happens to me in the fall is here in Edgartown. I live in the woods, in the deep woods, and there's a lot of vines and berries and grapes and cranberries and everything. And when the berries get, when they turn, they become alcoholic.
Oh, my.
And what happens is the birds eat the berries and they get drunk.
Oh no!
And it's true. And I couldn't understand why so many birds were hitting the glass in the autumn. And then I found out about the phenomenon of the turned berries, and and so all these drunk birds are running around hitting the windows and then falling down and then coming to and getting up. And so it's really a shame because, you know, when they're looking for food and once those berries have turned, there's not much you can do about it. But a lot of them are surviving this. But
wow.
I, too, saw the little things you can buy that are highly visible to the birds but hardly visible at all.
Although for drunk birds, it's probably not going to work.
Right, but you can get those at Duncraft. I've seen them in the Duncraft.
Yeah, I think
catalog,
most of the bird stores probably.
You know, it's an interesting. I've only seen drunk birds three times in my life, and
they're all around here because there's so many berries that are turning on the vine and dropping, and the birds.
It happens when you have big temperature swings. You know, it's real sunny in the day and cold at night. It causes some fermentation in the berries, and birds are so light. It doesn't take a lot to.
I see a fall field trip coming up.
It's really a shame. But,
I visited my sister in Juneau, Alaska, a number of years ago, and most of the houses downtown had crabapple trees, and all the crabapples had fermented, and flocks of Bohemian waxwings had come in. There were thousands of them eating the berries. And you walk around, and all the birds are floundering around with one wing.
Oh, no.
Every cat in town was walking around with a Bohemian waxwing in its nose.
Oh, no,
and
that's
it was
not
very,
a good story.
It was not a happy scene.
But on the turkeys, too, I just want to say that although I've had as many as 65, a herd of 65 in my yard here, I really like them in spite of the nastiness. Mm-hmm. And they're a huge pain on the roofs. Mm-hmm. They're a huge pain for the drains on the gutters.
Mm-hmm.
It's awful when they go on the roofs, but you can chase them away
pretty
easily.
Yeah. As long as you chase them. Yeah.
It is fun. The way to keep them away is to keep them from breeding in your yard. But
exactly.
I always like to have them breeding in my yard because I love watching the babies throughout the season grow into the little teenage footballs.
It's good that somebody likes them, yeah. Susan.
You're very tolerant. That's nice.
Susan, thanks for the phone call. We appreciate
Happy
that.
Happy you're on the air. Thanks.
All right, thanks. Okay. We should mention our bird call of the week, of the month, I guess. We're talking about great horned owls, first to breed in North America. Love that sound.
Yeah.
Is that what I think it is? On that bird call, it says the birds are copulating there.
Ah.
We're listening in on a private moment.
I've never heard them sound quite like that before. That's
we know what that call is.
This is more typical, the booming.
Yeah.
And the females are bigger than the males, about a third, and they both boom. They do duets, and the female has a baser, deeper hoot than the male. You can actually tell if it's a male or female when you hear both together.
So you don't have to see them; you can just tell by listening.
Right.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So we heard a call we don't get to normally hear. We have an email here from Dana. Says a couple years ago he sent a picture of a sandhill crane in Provincetown during the fall. And he said, thanks for helping explain that. Will it survive the winter?
It moved on, I think.
Oh, moved on. Okay.
Sure.
Right.
Sandhill cranes are very hardy, very rugged birds. And it's also one of the few, it's the only crane in the world that is actually increasing in numbers. They're doing very well. In fact, they're breeding in most New England states now. There's a few pairs. We have sandhill cranes breeding in western Massachusetts.
You know, he had a snowy egret. That's what he was asking.
Oh.
If that would survive the winter. I'm sorry, I got that. I didn't see the snowy egret.
When did he
part.
See the snowy egret?
He saw the snowy egret. It doesn't say when. It was recent.
This year was amazing, and there were some egrets on the bird counts, but no, it wouldn't survive a cold spell like we had last week. So
it
would have been better to go south.
Right. Bird News is coming to you the first Saturday of the month as we set out to see if there's support for perhaps a weekly program. We'd love to get your thoughts on what you like, what you don't, either on our Facebook page, which you can get to by going to our website, capeandislands.org. You can email us at birdnews@wgbh.org. We have our listener line where you can leave your comments, 508-548-9600, extension 103. Again, our email address is birdnews@wgbh.org, website capeandislands.org. I think the owl is still up there. You can click on the owl and that'll get you to... it isn't. I'm being told. No, it isn't. It's a robin now.
Okay.
That's where you'll find it. I'm Indy Todd along with ornithologist Vernon Locks. Thanks for listening.
Until next time, keep your eyes to the sky.
Bird News is produced by Amy Vince with help from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music is Harvest Time by Mike Marshall and Chris Thiele and is courtesy of Sugar Hill Records. Bird News is a production of WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station, a service of WGBH Radio.